How is everyone this week?
I'm good, thank you. All good, all good. How are you?
Good, thank you. I'm still here.
You're still here. I mean, we must be perilously close to your due date now.
Perilously close. But
I get so nervous.
Like
I get so nervous. I don't want to talk. I never want to mention anything when it comes to that.
You get nervous.
It's safe to talk about it, mate. That's not how it works.
Yeah, true.
But this is are you nervous, Claire? Are you kind of ready? Are you ready for it now?
I feel very full, and I'm not sure ready is the right word, but I feel I'd like it to happen sooner rather than later.
You don't even look big.
Thanks.
You don't.
What was that, Boz?
I said you don't even look big.
That's good.
Such a man with words, yeah.
Exactly.
Tell us, we've had some good feedback very from nice feedback. Last week.
We have. We've had a couple of really nice messages, actually. We had, firstly, I should say, we had a message about the episode from 2 weeks ago from Ed, aka MD's episode. So had a message from Von, who says that, so I used to work as a nurse in A&E in George's, which I think is St. George's in Tooting, I'm assuming, and was working Halloween night 2016 when Ed came in. Unfortunately, aww, he wasn't the only one that weekend, but it's good to hear he's doing well now. So look at that. That is a small world, isn't it? So
small world.
Yeah, thanks very much for the message, Vaughn. Boats, have you spoken to Ed?
Yeah. He actually listened to it and he proper enjoyed it. He really enjoyed it. I was happy to hear that. He literally just hit me up. He messaged me and said, yeah, he never knew that it was going to be so professional. He said the word certy, but yeah.
Thanks for translating.
That's all right.
Well, that's good.
And what
Claude,
do you reckon?
You had another message as well, didn't you?
Well, I had a message coming off Drew's episode last week from an organisation called NACRO, who reminded us that we should also have name checked them last week when we were talking about criminal record advice, and they are a similar support service. In some ways to Unlocked, who we did speak about last week, but they have a telephone service for people in prison, people who have left prison, families. So that's another place to check out NACRO if you're looking for any advice about criminal records or other sort of post-conviction prison support. So check them out. Do you think Drew's listened to season one yet?
Yeah, you know what? He messaged me as well. He said he enjoyed it as well.
He said he really enjoyed it.
So I'm glad.
We still need to chat to his mum.
We do. We've got her on the shortlist for any future episodes we do. Yeah. We might be. Do you reckon any of MD's mates listen, Boats? Are we reaching a new audience here with podcasts?
He might have told them, to be fair. He may have told them. So, yeah, I'll ask him. I'm going to message him. And
ratings will go shooting up, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. So what about this week? Who we got next?
We've got Eric, my uncle Eric, for full disclosure. So for some context, Eric, back in January 2019, was the victim of a serious violent crime in leafy suburban Kew in southwest London. So we're going to hear his story. I won't reveal too much now, but just a warning that some bits of this episode are a bit graphic.
Yeah, he didn't hold back, did he? He gave us kind of, yeah, I mean, again, not to reveal now, you'll hear in a sec, but it was, yeah, unbelievably interesting chat. I thought this was one of my favourites, and yeah, he was brilliant. So you'll hear all about it now.
And we'll leave him to start it off and tell us about that fateful Sunday morning.
I had my youngest son, Sam, who was here for the weekend back from university, and I went to buy the newspapers and went to my local coffee shop. I had a black North Face on top of my pyjamas, but underneath I only had pyjamas. And because you think you're going to go and get a cup of coffee in the newspapers, you don't want to come back all dressed. You want to come back in your pyjamas so you can have your coffee and read your newspapers. And anyway, so I go to the coffee shop, and it's my regular coffee shop, kind of go there every day. Chit-chat with Gino, who's there, who's the manager, who happens to be a Chelsea supporter. So we're talking about the Chelsea-Arsenal stuff that's happened that week. I pick up two cups of coffee, one for Sam, one for me, and then walk back to the car, which is just round the corner, and sit down in the car. And my door's still open at that stage. Suddenly I feel this presence just to my right. And there's a guy standing there. He's got a hoodie on. He's got, this is pre-COVID days, but he still had kind of like something covering his chin. So all I could really see were his eyes. But I feel his presence there. And he says, give me all your money. And it's a really weird thing because you don't know how you're going to react to something like that. And I think that if I'd been standing up and he was coming towards me, I'd have probably reacted differently. But I felt quite vulnerable sitting down with someone towering over me. So you've got nowhere to go. My instinct was to just scream at him and tell him to fuck off. I emitted a kind of very loud fuck off scream at him and stood up to confront him and ran after him. And then about, you know, probably 3 or 4 steps into running after him, I felt like my whole side was hot. And I looked at my jacket and it had changed colour and I realised that I'd been stabbed. So I ran back to the coffee shop. I mean, he ran off and just lay down on the floor. Blood was kind of pouring out. So Gino got me a cloth to put over my jacket to kind of try and keep the blood from coming out. And I called Sam, because obviously he was at home, and I just called him and just said, I've been stabbed. I'm at Torelli's, the coffee shop. And then just lay there. And Sam turned up after probably 10 minutes or so and took over in terms of cloth on the chest duties. We waited for an ambulance. And it took quite a long time. I think the ambulance probably took another 15 minutes or so.
Oh, and that's a long time.
It is a long time. It's a very long time. And it's a long time because you can just see the blood pouring out and you've got no idea really where you've been stabbed. And then, probably for an hour or so, I thought I was going to die because the blood was just kind of pouring out.
Did it feel painful? And yeah. I mean, maybe that's a stupid question. Obviously, it's going to be painful, but
no, it wasn't. It wasn't painful at all. I mean, I wasn't in pain at all.
Probably the adrenaline.
Maybe the adrenaline. I felt myself a bit lightheaded, but you know, eventually, I'd lost kind of 4 or 5 pints of blood. And anyway, the ambulance turns up, and the guy cut all my clothes because that was obviously the way to get them off. And he put me in the back of an ambulance and took me to there's a trauma ward at St Mary's in Paddington. And he took me there and Sam came in the police car just behind us.
Were you talking to the paramedics at this? So when they arrived, so you said you obviously know it's serious. Do you remember like the first thing you said to the paramedics when they arrived? Were you panicked? What was your kind of, how did that go?
No, I don't think I was panicked. I mean, I think he was just trying to keep me talking and not lose consciousness. And he did that kind of all the way to Paddington. And because it was 8 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday morning, once the ambulance actually turned up, it was probably only 20 minutes to Paddington. And I can't really remember what I talked to him about. I mean, he, you know, said and kind of asked what had happened or whatever. And yeah, and then we got in the ambulance and I got a kind of a couple of blood transfusions as soon as I got to the hospital. And then they did scans and stuff like that to see what had been cut. And so there was a period from kind of lying down, realizing that I'd been stabbed, to when the doctor told me that it hadn't cut and it hadn't punctured the heart, that it hadn't cut any major arteries, that I had a collapsed lung and had lost a lot of blood. But there was probably a 2.5 hour period that I thought that...
Two good bits of news there, one less so good. Did he kind of turd sandwich that one? Was it like, no, you haven't hit the heart. You got a punctured lung. We haven't hit any arteries. You're good to go.
Yeah, I mean, punctured. The bit that I missed out is once I got into hospital, they had to the first thing they did after a transfusion is they had to put a drain into my chest to start draining out all of the blood because your chest
builds up that fills cavity up
with blood, which I think is kind of it could be the source of onward infection and all kinds of problems with your lungs and stuff like that. I wish I could remember what it was, but they gave me this drug that my kids afterwards told me was a drug of choice at festivals, and it's a horse tranquilizer, and I can't remember
ketamine,
and honestly, I was in La La Land. I had the most incredible dreams, and I was, and that actually was the point that I thought I had died. Not that I was going to die, that I had died, because I was being transported through somewhere.
On a unicorn.
I was completely gone, and I could hear these voices. Gradually, my consciousness went,
and I could hear these
voices, and then it just went, and I was being transported through space and somewhere else, and it was just the weirdest experience. And then to be told later by my kids that it's a drug of choice at festivals was...
Is that how you sprung them? Is that you were like, oh, they gave me this drug. One of them's like, ketamine. Hang on, I got him. Hang on. You're grounded.
No. So after COVID, you're going to go straight to Glastonbury next year.
Glastonbury, yeah. It's quite a strong, I don't know if any of you have ever taken it, but it's quite a strong thing. Obviously, you're not going to...
They're going to stay quiet on that one.
Yeah, I got stabbed once at this festival called Wilderness. It's nice lad in a puffer jacket sorting me out.
Eric, going back, at what point did they tell you where you got stabbed?
When I got to hospital. So they kind of said, you know, you'd been, it kind of, the knife came in through this way, it cut through your nerves, it missed the artery by not very much. It punctured the lung. Not, it didn't puncture the lung. Your lung is in like a case.
Yeah.
And I guess it's in a case that the lung expands and contracts into, and it punctured the case. And then your lung collapses because all of the blood rushes into the lung cavity. Your lung can't expand because it's got nowhere to expand into because it's filled with blood. So that's why they put the drain in. They put, you know, they do another cut, basically stick a big pipe into your chest, and then they ask you basically to cough as much as you can, because every time you cough, you end up expelling blood from your lung cavity. That was it, really. And then I was in hospital for probably a week or so, and then the Gino became a minor celebrity. Daily Mail and the Times and places where he was interviewed, and saw him standing proudly outside the cafe.
Do you get free coffee for life now, Eric? Well,
that's a really good question, because that's what I would have expected. And I went in the following week, and they were obviously all kind of, how are you? And he said, as a special treat, we're going to give you today's coffee for free.
There is a businessman, isn't it? Today's coffee.
He's very clear.
I did get one coffee. I think it was a large one, so it was probably the £3.10 version.
To be fair, he probably had quite a lot of cleaning up to do.
Yeah, a lot of cleaning up, and he was closed for 3 days.
Okay.
So if anything, you owe him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, yeah. You can't buy press like that, Eric.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure you've made in business.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Just going back to the incident, had you seen the guy before he approached your car?
No, he kind of like appeared from nowhere.
So you hadn't seen like a sort of suspicious behaviour. And do you think he really wanted your money?
I think, I mean, they've... 3 months ago, I got a phone call to say that they'd matched DNA with someone who had committed another offence. And so I don't know whether it's the guy or not, but the person they've arrested for it was 16 at the time. So you kind of think, God, how sad is that, that a 16-year-old is doing that kind of thing? And there had been an incident in Kew the day before, apparently, that the police subsequently found out, where someone had approached a woman early in the morning and asked her for her handbag, and he had taken her handbag, and the descriptions matched. So, yeah, my guess is probably that he did want my money. I mean, it's but I mean, obviously you don't. Well, not obviously, but I don't really carry any cash.
Yeah.
So it's not like I've got at 8 o'clock in the morning that I've got lots of £10 notes in my pocket or anything like that. Yeah. And I drive a Ford Focus, so it's not like he would have looked at the car and thought, ooh.
You used all the tenors on the ketamine on Saturday night. They'd all gone Saturday night. You're down to just your card Sunday morning.
How do you know ketamine caused the tenor?
I said the tenor is unspecified. Said lots of tens. Multiples of tens.
Eric knows.
Yeah. Interesting one, Eric. I don't know how you said you got, like, have you, how to phrase this, have you been in a lot of fights?
Not with that face. Look at that. Yeah. Fight free.
Yeah, I'm not showing you my hands because they're workers' hands. No.
So I'm just interested, like, because...
It's not a natural reaction.
It's not a natural reaction to get... If someone's come at you and said, give me your money...
And they're on top of you. That's not a natural reaction to get up and say...
What is the natural reaction?
Normally, a lot of people go in their shell.
Yeah. But so I know, I think it's an interesting one that, you know, you've gone straight back at him. And, yeah, I think then... So I guess... Do you know when, have you been able to kind of think, but you said you kind of got to him and you only realised latterly that you'd been stabbed, but do you think he did it immediately and then ran, or he'd like turn when you were running? Was it, so as soon as you kind of got up, he...
He was away from me quickly. I mean, I screamed, stood up, like in his face, and then he ran. So he the only time that he was close enough to me was right when I kind of, as I was standing up.
Do you think it stabbed you before you screamed?
I don't know. I think screaming was my first. I think so, because screaming was the first.
So you're quite a calm person. Like, I don't think you'd have just screamed in someone's face that had said, give me money.
Yeah, but the adrenaline is, when you've got someone standing right next to you who's all kind of, you know, masked up and everything. Yeah. Yeah. It's quite an intimidating presence, and you've got nowhere to go. And
they're so close. They're like,
and they're so close.
Maybe it's, yeah, that's your kind of, that is, maybe that is the instinct to try and get them away from you. I don't know.
Yeah, that's why I say, I don't know, but if someone had been walking towards me and I'd been in the street, I'd have probably, who knows, but my guess is that I'd have either given him some money or just ran. Yeah. I wouldn't have picked a fight with him.
Also, going back to like a week later when you were discharged and you went straight back to the coffee shop, didn't you feel scared to go back there, or was you just all right with it?
No, I didn't feel scared going back, and I kind of go there still because it's right near the tube station. So when I was still taking the tube, I'd go past that same spot every day, and I still go past that same spot every day. So no, I didn't feel at all scared. I mean, the only thing is, you know, I didn't sleep for probably 3 months or so properly. And I still, when I'm walking home from the tube station in the dark, I still look behind me to see if there's anyone there.
Yeah, naturally.
That's the only kind of thing that, but I don't feel scared about it at all. And I don't feel kind of, as I walk past the place where it happened, it doesn't bring back terrible memories or anything like that. It makes me feel like, that is so surreal that could happen in that place at 8 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday morning. But it doesn't make me feel scared at all.
Has your outlook on life changed? I mean, you know, talk about, I mean, I don't think many people out there have had, I don't know, but had an incident where they convinced they're going to die. You know, where you're lying on the floor of a cafe, blood pumping out of you, and you know, in your words, you know, you said you thought you were going to die. Has that changed you since, do you think?
You know, I don't know if it by itself has changed me. And we were, I went straight back to work 3 days after coming out of hospital, which was a week too early, really. But we were in the middle of selling the business. It was a really busy time at work. I didn't feel that I couldn't be there. And then I stopped working. After we sold the business, I decided not to stay in the business. And I think that it was probably one of the things that made me feel that kind of life's too short and you shouldn't really spend tons of time just doing things just because that's what you've been doing. And it wasn't, I don't think there was a direct kind of link between that and I'm going to give up work or I'm going to do something different. But I think it was, you know, along with...
Maybe with nudged you one way. Maybe gave you a little bit of a nudge one way as opposed
yeah.
to...
Yeah, and it does make you think a bit more, you know, just do the things that you really want to do. And so it was somewhere there in the mix. I don't think it was the driving factor. And it wasn't that... I suddenly woke up and thought, oh my God, you know, there's all of these things that I wish I was doing. Like I never speak to my lovely niece, Claire, and I really must spend more time with her now. And it wasn't I didn't have a long list of things that I had regrets about that I thought, right.
Yeah, it wasn't like this big epiphany.
Now I'm going to go and be nice to the neighbour and I'm going to go yeah. and do all of these things. And so... It didn't have that kind of effect on me.
I can remember going to see you in the hospital and yeah. I can remember you in your sort of typical non-dramatic way about yourself being like actually quite shocked and traumatised by the people who were in that ward with you and what they had gone through.
Yeah, I mean, they had two wards. They had a male ward and a female ward and they had 8 beds in each. The male ward, I mean, I was by far and away the best off there. I mean, there was a 17-year-old or 18-year-old who had been stabbed 6 or 7 times in his stomach, had a couple of his fingers chopped off. There was another guy who had been stabbed. So there was three of us who had been stabbed out of the 8. There was a lovely old guy of, you know, he was probably in his mid-60s, used to cycle every weekend to see Fulham and had been hit by a car on his way to the Fulham game and had like terrible head injuries, couldn't walk properly. There was a guy who had fallen off a building site onto his head. So there was people with some really serious stuff. And then in the female ward, there was a woman who I think also had other kind of mental health issues. She would spend the whole night and a lot of the day screaming, saying, get off me, get off me. And she didn't want anyone to like look after her doctor wise. And you know, I need to go home. I want to go home. Get off me, get off me. And then after the first night, you had her saying, get off me, leave me alone. I want to go home. And the woman next to her saying, shut the fuck up, shut the fuck up, shut the fuck up. And
it sounds like the induction wing in every prison I've been in.
But it went on. I mean, the idea of hospitals being places where you can rest, it was noisy the whole time because you had this screaming going on and you had the nurses going round checking everyone every 2 hours. They'd wake you up every 2 hours to take your kind of vital signs and check whatever. And so they were waking people up every 2 hours. So everyone was awake most of the night and you had these two women screaming at each other. It was a noisy place.
So that again, that probably added to that kind of surreal feeling.
Yeah. Like, yeah. But I think, I mean, overall, you know, you can look at that kind of experience that I had and think, God, that was really unlucky being in queue and being stabbed like that. And honestly, I don't really think of it that way. I kind of actually think I'm so lucky. What could have happened, I mean, quite apart from dying, I could have been in a wheelchair for the rest of my life. I could have, I'm quite sporty. I go cycling, I play football. I could have lost the ability to do all of that. So I don't look at it and think, oh, I'm so unlucky. That's so awful. I can't believe it happened to me. I actually think I'm so lucky. I had that experience, which was a bit of a surreal experience, and I've come out of it largely unscathed.
Do you think about it often?
I think about it every time I walk past the spot where it happened, which is every day.
Yeah. But you don't dwell on it?
No, I don't. It doesn't. I don't kind of.
Every time you got to hand £3.10 over to Gino. Tight git.
Gino's left to go and set up a cafe in Blackheath.
Well, he's opened up a second shop with all that PR money.
Yeah, that's it.
And Eric, you were saying that just recently you get this call to say some prints had matched. And up until, so if you go back to the time, which is, 2 years ago now, that at the time they had no leads, no evidence, nothing.
No, I mean, they had some CCTV footage, but they couldn't identify him from it. He dropped the knife, so they had the knife with DNA on it, but it didn't match anything. I couldn't identify someone. So they had various pieces. It turns out that there was a neighbor in that street who saw someone dropping the knife and running away. But so they had fragments of things like that. And the police were good at the time. I mean, they kind of kept me informed. I mean, my just practical things, like they obviously took my car away, so I had to go to the pound in Ealing and pick it up. And like the keys to the house, the keys to the car had gone. I had to buy new pyjamas. There was kind of some serious stuff that I had to deal with, and a new North Face jacket.
Yeah, they are expensive, those.
So,
has it affected what you wear to the news agents now?
They stopped making that same jacket, actually. So I've actually got a blue jacket instead of a black jacket. So that's a big change.
Do you now go in like really respectable clobber just in case?
But to be fair, it's a good thing you wore pajamas because it's easy. It would have been easier to cut off.
A lot easier to cut.
Could have saved your life.
And I have to be honest and say that I don't go out to get my coffee and the papers at the weekend in pajamas anymore.
So it has changed you. What were your feelings about the fact that at the time you thought you wouldn't have that sense of closure, that it was just going to be this, you weren't ever going to know who had done it? I mean, we still don't know. Like you say, there's been someone arrested. We don't know. They haven't been convicted yet. But did that feel open-ended? Do you, without any of that information? Or
no. I have to say that I didn't think about him very much. And the fact that no one had been arrested, it wasn't something that I was kind of worried about, or that I thought that that I needed to worry about. So I actually, in 2 years, I haven't really given him much thought. And it's only in the last, it's probably 3 or 4 months ago, maybe it's a bit longer, maybe it's 5 months ago, that the police rang up and said, you know, someone committed another offence. We've now matched the DNA. Wanted to let you know because we're going to arrest him in the morning and it's going to be in the papers. So we just wanted to let you know before that happens. And they were quite good. I mean, they let me know before they arrested him. They let me know once they'd arrested him. They then released him. They then rearrested him. And they kind of kept me updated all the way through, and there's now a trial date set for May that they've asked me to appear at. But until all of that stuff happened, I hadn't really thought about him at all.
I think that's quite unusual.
I don't know. I've only been stabbed once.
But do you think because that you couldn't put like a name to the face, as it were, or actually give it to someone, maybe that's why you hadn't thought about it? Do you think that, let's say, for example, this guy is convicted and they confirm that he was the guy that did it, do you think that will change that you'll have actually like an actual human to kind of commit the kind of that thought process to?
I mean, his when they arrested him, they did put out a statement with his name and his age and stuff like that. And I didn't go onto Google to have a look at what he looked like or try and find out anything about him or anything like that. So I'm not kind of consumed by him or want to know lots about him. I mean, other than knowing that he's kind of local and was 16 at the time, which I find incredibly sad, really, that a 16-year-old is out there carrying a knife, threatening people, whether he meant to stab me or not, who knows. But the very fact that he's out age 16 with a knife and is threatening people, I just think it's kind of sad more than anything else.
And do you have a sense of what you would want to happen at the trial? Assuming, for example, he is convicted.
What you mean, like how long do I want him to go to prison for?
Yeah, do you have any sense of... revenge isn't the right word at all, but any sense of what might feel like justice to you? Or do you feel quite removed from that?
Yeah, I feel quite removed. I mean, as I haven't really been thinking about him for a couple of years. Mm. It's not that I've been trying to track someone down and... I don't have a kind of placard and are going to be outside Kingston Crown Court with kind of, you know, justice for the Q1 or anything. So it's not that. I think, as I say, assuming it is him and he's found guilty, he'll get whatever sentence.
What do you know? What he's been charged with?
I told Claire at the time, and I've forgotten. Is it Section 18 or
wounding with intent? Probably.
Yeah, I think it was Section 18, but I can't remember.
Sounds right.
So, I mean, he'll get whatever he gets if he's convicted. And
you're very pragmatic about the whole thing.
Very. Yeah, but I was talking to I do personal training out on the green with a guy who lives in Brentford, and he's lived in Brentford all of his life, and we were talking about it this morning, and they're building lots of new flats and shops and stuff like that there, and there's no real community facilities. And if you think about COVID now, and you think about, there's a lot less job opportunities, there's a lot fewer pub jobs and restaurant jobs, and so you're going to get a whole load of 16 and 17 and 18 year olds without much to do. And where are they going to hang out in Brentford? I mean, it's all just shops and flats now.
So where are they going to get any money, and where are they going to hang out?
I'd like him to be treated fairly, and if it is him, get whatever, you know, sentence he should get. But actually, the kind of underlying thing is, it's really sad that a 16-year-old is walking around with a knife, and you kind of think it's going to happen a lot more because you've got a whole bunch of 16, 17, 18-year-olds without jobs, without anywhere in particular to hang out. So coming back to your question, I'm not, I don't really think about him very much. I'm not driven by any sense of justice means X. It'll be what it'll be. The kind of irony in a way is that his life will have been a lot more affected than mine.
And what about, Eric, the media? You got quite a lot of media attention. I mean, obviously, that's partly to do with your business, but also I think partly the fact that it was in queue, and that becomes an interesting aspect of the story, supposedly, for people. How did you find? Did you find that quite intrusive?
Yeah, that was the worst. That was the worst part of it. At the time, it was definitely the worst part. It was the worst part because, I mean, there was a lot of attention about it, much more than there should have been. And it was partly because I'm kind of white, middle class businessman living in Kew. And the same week, there was a 15-year-old black kid who got stabbed and killed. And the two incidents happened like within 24 hours of each other. So there was a few, and the Times even had an editorial about us contrasting the experience of the 15-year-old and my experience. And the press were really intrusive. I mean, the press followed my kids home. They waited outside their flats. They put a letter through Claire's parents' door wanting to find out more information. They tracked down my ex-wife and put a letter through her door wanting to interview her. They rang me up constantly. They turned up at the hospital. The hospital arranged a password with me so that when people turned up saying they were coming to see me, they could check to see whether or not they were really legit or not. And there were journalists turning up, pretending they were friends and relatives trying to come up to the ward. And in the end, I contacted the kind of owners of the Times and threatened legal action against them if they didn't stop, because it was actually the Times that was the worst offender on all of this, for whatever reason. So that was all. When I was lying in hospital, I didn't really want the added hassle of thinking that my kids were being harassed by the press or that relatives were being harassed by the press. I hadn't told my parents that I'd been stabbed. I only told them when I knew that there was about to be an article in the press, and I knew it was in a paper they read. So I had not told them about it for a couple of days. So the thought that they were being harassed, that my kids were being harassed, that my brother, that my ex-wife were being harassed, and you're lying in hospital. And I'd said to the press that I didn't want to talk to anyone, that I didn't want to give any interviews or anything like that. That was intrusive.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think how the papers and stuff deal with knife crime is obviously an issue. And I don't know either way on this, because I've heard both bits. But, you know, I've heard that whether or not it's actually as big a problem as we're led to believe. But the reason I say that's interesting is they're clearly so desperate to get the inside scoop or the story from you on that, because it sells papers. And so it's a really interesting take. You know, it's interesting to hear that they are clearly, you know, so desperate to get your story on that, because obviously they want to, you know, get that on the front page. They can create a big story around it.
There was quite a few stories that week about it. And I think for the papers, it's, I'm not part of a gang. Mm. There isn't a kind of, big white middle-class Q versus white middle-class Richmond gang warfare going on.
Well, it's just for the readers of the Times, for them to pick up and go, oh God, it's even reached Q now. Do you mean like that's kind of how you know, you feel, you don't know, but you feel like
it's everybody's problem. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That's the story. It's not, there are hundreds of people, unfortunately, who die every year from knife crime, but it's just a way of bringing to the middle class that you're not safe. That's the story. I tell you, the thing that always makes me kind of laugh is when people say to me, how was your accident? And I kind of say, well, it wasn't actually an accident. And it's a weird thing that people feel unable to to use words like "since you were stabbed." But they prefer to say, "Has anything happened to you since your accident?"
Have you, that's an interesting one. Have you found kind of friends or like people like that treat you differently since? I mean, obviously, Gino's upped his coffee prices, but has anyone else anyone else kind of treated you differently? Friends, like, other than that?
No, I mean, I had, when I went back to playing football on a Saturday morning, obviously there was kind of some interest as to whether or not I'd be able to run around or not, and kind of what my lung capacity was like and stuff like that.
Eric, it feels, not to sort of lighten the mood too much, but we have two questions that we've been asking all of our guests, and it feels only appropriate that we ask you before you go. The first one is, if you could change anything in the criminal justice system, what would it be? No money, no, you know, there's no politics involved in it. You just, you've got a golden wish.
I don't know enough about the criminal justice system to know really what I'd change.
Well, what about anything in your experience?
I guess that delaying stuff, if I was really worried about it, the time that passes would be an issue, I think, for, you know, for the people who are arrested and for the people who are victims. Yeah. If I look at this guy who was arrested, let's say it was about 5 months ago, he's had a couple of court hearings. He hasn't pleaded in either of them. There's a court case set for May. That will probably be 9 months since he was arrested.
Which is actually quite speedy at the moment, if you look at the delays that are happening.
I guess if I was really anxious about it, that would feel like quite Definitely. A long time. And if he was, I don't know anything about him, but if he was in a certain situation, that would feel like quite a long time. So I'd say maybe kind of speeding everything up would be helpful for the people arrested and for the victims.
And in fact, not to make him the victim here, but similarly, in terms of what we're talking about, the delay, he will get a very different sentence now. He will be sentenced as an adult, not as a child. So that will be a huge difference to the outcome for him.
Well, and that's because he's over 18 yeah. now.
It doesn't go from the date of the offence. It goes from the date of conviction. So that will make a big difference for his sentence. And then finally, if you were unfortunate enough to be on the other side and spend a year in prison, who would your dream cellmate be?
And does it have to be a same sex no. thing?
Here we go.
Do you want us to edit that bit out, Eric?
No. Well, if it's, I'm just going to answer it on the basis of it's a same sex answer as opposed to a romantic, like, oh, it'd be so.
I'm not sure prison cells. So
I can tell you now, Eric, there's nothing romantic about a prison cell.
Not a lot of privacy.
Yeah. I would probably go for Arsene Wenger, the ex-manager of Arsenal, because you can talk about Arsenal to your heart's content.
I'll tell you what, he'd love that.
But the only thing is, I saw him interviewed on, because he's just published his autobiography, and he was on Graham Norton the other night, and he didn't have much of a sense of humour. So I think a year with someone like talking earnestly about things might be quite a long time. So I might try and alternate him with Richard Curtis, who I work with at Comic Relief, who would provide a kind of...
Well, they do have, in Rochester, they had three-man cells. So maybe that is that is a good little three-ball, that. You, Arsene, and Richard Curtis. That's a sitcom waiting to happen.
Richard would make a film out of it.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
Everyone's winning.
Love, it would be Love Actually too.
We've been waiting for it to happen.
Yeah. Love in prison.
Yeah.
This has been so interesting. Thank you.
Yeah,
and
it really
I think
has.
Without any, maybe a bit of bias, but without too much bias, I think you have quite a remarkable outlook on your experience.
Definitely.
And I think that should be applauded. And good luck.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that the word for the trial? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But thank you so much.
Yeah. To be fair, I really enjoyed that. I think the funniest thing about it all is how chilled he was. Like, if I went through that, I would not be chilled.
Yeah, I don't feel in a position to tell anyone how to react to getting stabbed. But he was so, yeah, pragmatic and kind of chilled about the whole thing, wasn't he?
Very unrevengeful. I think I just made that word up. Let's cut that out.
It works. No, I think it works.
It works.
Yeah. Unrevengeful.
You know what you meant. Yeah, I think. The court date will probably be coming up quite soon, I guess, wasn't it?
This month, yeah, must be. So maybe we could keep our listeners in the know with what happens.
How is Eric doing, Claire?
He's very well. I saw him yesterday, and no, he's very good. He's very good.
Rob, didn't you say he DM'd you asking for some keza?
Yeah, really weird. I had a message at like 3 a.m. the other night asking if I had any special K.
What is it?
I don't know what that meant. But
yeah, what is keza? I don't even know what that is.
We'll sort it out for him for his release episode.
Let's have some reviews from the last week, because I know I've been enjoying doing the pod, but it's not just us three enjoying it. We've had a couple of messages. We've had one from Rob Manafield. Says, I mean, I could just leave it at the first line, which is Banged Up is a phenomenal prison podcast. Season one is one of my favourite seasons of any podcast ever. So thanks very much, Rob.
Appreciate that.
Messy Jesse says, no nonsense podcast with human stories and insights into many aspects of prison. Diverse voices, diverse perspectives, great hosts. So yeah, very nice. Oh. Nice. So keep those reviews coming, guys. Let us know how much you're enjoying the
Rob, you've got to say that funny one, surely.
Okay, yeah. Name check.
So this was a message on our Instagram. It was from someone called Dan2000 said, on a lighter note, my daughter was watching Made in Chelsea last night, and by God, every single one of them sounded like Rob.
That's what I said to you as well. I said, you sound like you're from Made in Chelsea.
That kind of bigotry will not be tolerated on this podcast, I'm afraid. We do not all sound and look the same, okay? any kind of feedback like that, always welcome. We probably won't read most of it out, but, you know, send us something good. You might get a shout out. Boats is avidly checking our Instagram, so...
Something like that, yeah.
Almost as closely as he's watching our partnership with Redemption Roasters. If, like Boats, you don't like coffee, then don't worry. But if you do and you want to support the pod, Banged Up 25 gets you 25% off everything edible or consumable, basically, both online and in their cafes dotted around London. So yeah, if you want to support the pod and you don't want to hand your money over to some giant coffee conglomerate, then go to Redemption Roasters and get stuck in.
What a busy
Look, get that real-time feedback from Boats. I'm trying here, mate.
Say conglomerate.
Conglomerate, yeah.
Sir.
There we go. See, we're educating each other here. You now know conglomerate. I know Surtee.
Yeah, true.
Oh, dear. Who have we got next week?
So next week's guest is someone you and I know very well, Boats. It's our good mate from Rochester, Barry. Go on, Boats. You describe Barry in 3 sentences or less.
Barry's a ledge. He's funny as, yeah, he's a ledge. He loved himself as well. And yeah, he's a ledge.
Yeah, but that is a really, really apt description. I think this is a man who had circa 100 photos of himself up on his prison, on his cell wall. But yeah, one of our really, really good mates. I actually had lunch with him on Sunday. He's on cracking form. Really interesting perspective as well, actually. You know, he's from a very different background, definitely myself. He's from the traveller community. So we hear a little bit about that and how that affected his experiences in prison. But yeah, great episode. Really looking forward to it.
And I think season one, he got name checked a lot for his cookery skills, his tuna burger. So I think you've got to get a recipe from him, Rob, and share it with our listeners on Instagram. And have a competition. Send us your photos of you cooking Barry's tuna burgers and we'll rate them. And Rob, you have to be included in that.
I feel a little challenge coming on.
You'll actually do it as well.
I mean, yeah, I actually will. Okay, leave it with us. We keep an eye on our Instagram at bangeduppod. And we will put some details of some kind of culinary challenge out there. And
Rob, you better warn your girlfriend that she's got tuna burgers every night this week while you perfect the recipe.
Yeah, beware, Grace. So we will get that out there on the Instagram this week. And then the eagle-eyed amongst you will have noticed, yeah, we've reverted to every other week for our prison-themed question. So we'll definitely get that out there this week. We are going with the question of this week is we want to know your favourite prison related song. Examples might be Akon, Locked Up. I think we've already name checked him. He's got a double shout out on the pod this series. Johnny Cash, Live in Folsom Prison. Any other suggestions?
Not heard that one. Don't give them all away.
Okay, so yeah, keep an eye. We've had a week off on Instagram, but keep an eye this week because it is going to be a flurry of activity. So we promise.
Well, until then,
I better get going. I've got a busy weekend of me.
Hopefully, yeah, see you next week and with Barry's episode. Can't wait.
Happy days.
Looking forward to it. Cheers, guys. See you next week.